Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to a brand new season of Don't Quote Me. I'm your host, Orla Condon, and this week I'm joined by podcaster Cian Sullivan, who many of you will know from his work on City That Pod, but also from regular appearances on My Bottom Paper. Coming up on today's show, Love is Blind faces fresh criticism as new season comes to an end. Coachella ended this weekend, but has its influence on all aspects of pop culture ended too. And Drew Barrymore has become the darling of daytime TV, and for good reason, and we're going to discuss. In other news, we're talking about how Married at First Sight Australia is delivering another amazing season, and why Cian is obsessed with Netflix's beef. It's a must watch, absolutely. Let's get stuck in. Okay, we're back for season two, a little bit later than I expected, but here we are, and joining me, Cian Sullivan, a regular voice in My Pot and Paper's listeners' ears. That felt more of a soft sentence in my mind and came out quite clunky. How are you?
Good, good. Happy to be back, be chatting about these erratic Americans who are looking for love. And other things, and yeah, just keeping busy, keeping my eye on the pop culture as always.
Very busy season for you in the last couple of months with Drag Race, another season coming to an end. What are we at now? I mean, how many seasons has Sissy That Pod covered?
What a brilliant question. I think I'm near, if not north of 20.
Wow. 20 seasons mm-hmm. of Drag Race. That's insane. That's mm-hmm. insane. How are you finding it now after finishing another series? Are you feeling a bit fatigued? Was it, from all the reports I saw, as not a very active viewer, it was a good series?
It was a good season. So I guess there's multiple things going on. I do Sissy That Pod, the Drag Race reaction podcast. I'm now doing it on my own. My work husband has, gone for... further ventures somewhere else. He's hanging out with the woman next door and going back to college. So I'm trying to find a new way of doing it, laying it myself. But yes, season 15 was kind of different because I had a new co-host which kind of felt new and fresh to me. The season itself was good, but they moved it to a new home on MTV.
Yeah.
So that it was only 40 minutes long. But it wasn't filmed to be 40 minutes. It was filmed to be an hour plus. So there was these drag queens who had spent tens of thousands of dollars on their looks. And when it came to them being shown on the TV show, they were like 6 seconds.
No.
Like, I think at times I counted an average of like 7 to 8 seconds per drag queen on the runway.
Stop.
And like, there's really iconic challenges like Snatch Game, in which, the queens have to do impersonations of people. And they had done this. They decided to do it really early in the season so that there was like 14 people doing it And like, ideally, it would take whatever 20 minutes of the airtime. But again, then they could have done 40 minutes. It ended up being like 10 minutes. So it was just, things were just really crammed in. And you didn't really get to know the contestants as well as you normally would. Then maybe like 8 episodes into the season, they reverted back to an hour long episodes when we kind of lost half the cast. And we didn't even need it. So all that being said, they were a very talented bunch of queens. Some really fun challenges, but I think the actual production of it messed it up.
Yeah. And isn't it so interesting as well? Like, obviously, we've spoken a lot about like reality TV production on our various podcasts. We're talking a little bit about it again on this episode. But like, it is impossible to overstate the importance of the network, the importance of the production team working on these shows and how it impacts the general look and feel. And like, even recently seeing the news of, I mean, we discussed it on my pod and paper about Love Island getting an all-star series, mm-hmm. and we were quite excited. It's now been confirmed that it's going to Peacock, the streaming service in the US, which just paints a totally different picture of what I imagined the all-star season would be, because mm-hmm. that comes with a look and a feel and a limit for what's okay and what's not, and all of that stuff that's packaged up with a network's identity. And that's another great example of them not potentially not maybe understanding the value of, because I presume for something like Snatch Game, everyone probably got like what, one punchline, like probably just got like one little moment to be like their character rather than to actually have a, like a scene.
Yeah, unless you were one of the better ones, you got maybe 3 or 4 moments rather than like a full opportunity to show off your drag. Yeah, so which was, you know, disappointing. And because if it's going to be on Peacock, does that mean it's going to be the US Love Island team that are producing it, do you know?
So it's going to be cast members from the US, UK and Australia all mm-hmm. combined, but I'm not sure about who's, I would imagine so, given Love Island US is also hosted on Peacock. I think there's going to be pluses and minuses to it. It's definitely got me a little bit more interested because I think it's going to be somewhat of a different format to what we, the everyday mm-hmm. ITV viewer, is used to. I'm also very curious. I mean, I watch a lot of Housewives content, Bravo content on Peacock, where drinking limitations don't seem to be in place. Mm-hmm. The same kinds of duty of care structures don't seem to be in place. So it's going to be interesting to see how they kind of pick up that weight of responsibility from the UK show, try and incorporate it into their streaming service, but also still create something that fits the Peacock brand, which Love Island UK would not really at the minute. So
I believe that they have to do challenges every day or something like that to like stay on the island.
I saw something about that as well, which again, I mean, we discussed, I'm not sure if me and you discussed this in my bottom paper, but I definitely discussed this throughout the series that stuff like that is what we want to see, right? Like that's kind of a change in the structure that adds more jeopardy without messing with people's minds. Like it's just like you lose the game, like you're in danger, like that, them's the breaks. So I'm intrigued. I think they're looking at like a October, November release, which will mean for everyone who's watched all three, we'll have had 3 seasons of Love Island in 1 year, which, I mean, there's gotta be oversaturation.
I feel your pain. I have a minimum of 3, and then I do all the international franchises as well, and my bonus.
They're like,
feed,
so, if the queens can do it, so can we. I'm like, oh gosh.
But like, it kind of sounds like, do you know that American reality show, The Challenge? I've never watched it, but it just seems to be hot people from other reality shows in a Fear Factor style format. That's kind of the vibe I was getting off this Love Island thing. I'm not sure if I love it. What you're saying about like challenges that actually affect the outcome of the villa, all up for that.
Yeah. But
like if this is, you know, Georgia Steele, like sort of zip lining, I don't know, care if I care about that.
Yeah. No, I wanted to fit the vibe. Like I don't want them to be like, oh, they have to like Survivor style, have to stand out in a plank of wood in the ocean for hours on end and see your last slug. No, don't want that.
Olivia eating witchetty grubs, that sort of like vibe.
Yeah. I imagine they're going to find a look and feel that works for the brand. I mean, I know as much as the next guy, I've just seen the reports on various entertainment websites, but it definitely has me intrigued. I just think a third ITV production in 1 year would be a lot. At least this looks like it's going to be something quite different. Right, our first story this week that we're diving into is going to be, it's going to be an interesting one to talk to you about, Cian, because you are not a fan nor a viewer of the show for reasons we'll get into, but there has been a lot of controversy this week for many different reasons about Love is Blind, the new season that just finished, the reunion that was an absolute mess, the host, the production, the, you know, duty of care towards contestants. It's in a whole lot of hot water this week. And I don't think anyone expected it to kind of spiral and kind of gather momentum as much as it has. Firstly, Kian, you do not like this type of reality TV show. Would you like to explain why?
So I watched season one of Love is Blind in the lockdown. And I couldn't watch episode two. I just couldn't bring myself to watch them get engaged to people they hadn't seen. And there's something about people getting married in a way that I deem reckless that just annoys me. I'm just like, why? I just don't understand. It gives me sort of like an anxiety and a level of annoyance that I'm like, you don't need to make these decisions now. Take your time. And I'm like, on one side, I'm like, this is literally none of your business. Why are you getting so emotionally invested? Let people live their lives the way they want to. Yeah. But it's some sort of quirk. I've spoken about it in therapy. I still haven't got to the bottom of it. People have said to me, oh, is because, you know, as a queer person, you've had to fight for the right to be married. And, you know, here's some straight people, you know, basically taking a piss out of it. But I think I'd still be annoyed if it was the same sex couple. Like, there's Married at First Sight same sex couples, and the idea still annoys me. So I don't know what it is of just, and who is it? Oh, what's your man? In the first season, he went by a second name. It was like Matthew something. He ended up with a small girl with brown hair. And I think this
No, they broke up, I think. But oh, I think I know the couple.
But she had like crippling debt. And he married her anyway. And that set me into a tailspin. I was like, how could you marry somebody without knowing their financial situation? It's just like, I find it so stressful and annoying.
Yes, I remember. It's the main two, Amber and Barnett, them two, wasn't it?
Yes, Amber and Barnett. Yeah, exactly. That I just couldn't get to. So I watched... So I skipped episode two because I couldn't deal with them, you know, getting the engaged.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind then after that when there was just the couples kind of, you know, finding their feet and going and, you know, meeting the parents. I didn't really mind that. Watching Jessica feed her dog wine. Like, I didn't mind that aspect of it. But when season two came around, I said, you know what? I'm not going to put myself through the unnecessary annoyance. There's plenty of reality TV that I shouldn't be watching. I'll watch that instead.
Absolutely. Ain't that the truth? I find Love is Blind, it falls into the kind of selling sunset category of reality TV for me with regards to like entertainment. Do I think it's one of the best reality TV shows that's on? Absolutely not. Like, absolutely not. There is something about Netflix reality TV that just never scratches the itch for me. It just never hits the mark as well as so many other amazing franchises do. But Love is Blind is such a buzzy show. There's always discussions around it. So I always just watch it. And same for Selling Sunset. I always just watch it to make sure that like I know what people are talking about. And like if there is a big story, I kind of understand what's going on. But it is very much a second screen kind of viewing for me. Like I'm not bet into it. It's not hooking me in. You know, when you get through that the three episodes and you have to wait a week, I'm not gutted that I have to wait a week. It's like, it's fine. But the show never disappointed me as much as it did for this season's reunion that just passed. Netflix had been hyping this for a couple of weeks that it was going to be their first live event on the platform, that it was going to be a live reunion with live reactions from a live audience with all of the favorite quote unquote couples and participants there. And then as we were waking up, I think on Monday morning, you were seeing the kind of the fallout in the US overnight, that there was major issues getting the live stream going, that they were massively delayed. And eventually they had to abandon the live stream and record what they had done and then release it. I think it was like over 24 hours later, it was released on Netflix here. So it was really, really embarrassing. It was a big mess up. And then when the reunion came out and people started watching it, it was like, oh my God, all of this for this, because it was just, and I know obviously you're not a huge fan, but you are a fan of reality TV who has sat through numerous reunions on numerous different shows. this was by far one of the worst reunions. And I've sat through many a Love Island reunion where in early years when they had no fucking clue what they were doing. This was awful.
So I guess for the listener, I have seen this.
Yeah.
I didn't watch the season. I only watched the reunion ahead of this conversation. So if people are listening and they haven't seen it either, I'll probably have some questions that you can add context to as well. I mean, it's hard for me to gauge whether it was good or not because I don't know how much information had been rehashed because it was all new to me.
Yeah.
In this particular scenario, I was kind of hoping for more throwbacks to the actual season to know what was actually happening. But my biggest takeaway was that the fandom seems to be a toxic pit. Like they seem to be like, you know, oh, let's just confirm, Kwame, you know, that your sister is actually your sister and your mom isn't a paid actress. And I was like, what sort of shenanigans was going on online during this season?
Oh my God. And they kept referencing it, right? Like Nick and Vanessa Lachey, the host, kept referencing social media. A couple of times they called it the fourth wall, and I was like, what the fuck?
That doesn't make sense. That's not the fourth wall.
What are these two? Like, seriously, come on.
I like Vanessa though, and I think
Ian, are you joking? She was the controversy. She was literally the lightning rod. How did you like her? Oh my God, this is so interesting because I obviously watched the series and was fuming with her, but you liked her?
I like her in that I like that she's better than fucking Nick. I guess I watched The Ultimatum because that's fine. That's couples who are actually together and they're having a quabble. I'm perfectly fine with that. So I watched that. I see them in that. And I don't think they're the best presenters, but I kind of appreciate that they're presenting it as a couple and that they're willing to sort of open up their relationship, kind of somewhat, not really in it. But I guess I was just thinking, like, I think she did a relatively good job being like, hey guys, I'm sorry we're not live, you know, like address you straight away. I think she's somewhat warm in her delivery. And I guess it's just because you have ice, you know, wooden scarecrow of Nick Lachey beside her that she seems so exuberant, but like she's also a TV presenter, like she presented TRL and like she was in one of those NCIS as well, so it makes sense that she's better at this than he is. But I think I was just more reassessing my opinion because when I first heard of her I was like, who the fuck is Vanessa Lachey? And now I obviously know more about her and I was like, Joe, she's actually not too bad at this.
Okay, so when the series first started, I remember her and Nick were very much like ever present in the show, like it felt like they're sharing about their experiences as a couple, difficulties they faced, all that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, they even referenced Jessica Simpson and Nick Lachey coming out of that marriage and how they handled all of that. And it felt very relevant because they were kind of, like I said, ever present throughout the series. Whereas, and even I think Vanessa referenced it in this reunion, that they are not as present anymore. So then when they come in at the reunion and she's like, oh, come here, me and my man and me and our babies. And I'm like, no one cares. You're not here. Like, we have not paid you attention for weeks. We don't care about how this relates to your life. Yes, if you're using that in a way to like leverage them to kind of talk a little bit more, if you're using it as like a prod to be like, I'll open up, so hopefully you'll open up, grand. But it just felt like so self-indulgent from her. And then there was a lot of backlash about how many times, and I'm curious if you noticed this, how many times, you know, Love is Blind babies were mentioned, her kind of harping on constantly about whether couples were trying or whether they were pregnant or what the plan was, which again, like, even when Love is Blind started, mightn't have sounded that jarring, which was only, what, 2.5-3 years ago. But already, like, how much just kind of pop culture has changed and how much our willingness to listen to that kind of question, our sensitivity around those kinds of questions have changed. It came off really bad and people were really annoyed about it. And there was a lot of criticism for her harping on the baby question, as people were calling it on Twitter.
That kind of got my back over the baby question, but I was kind of like, oh, probably fans of the show won't find it annoying, it's just me being my cynical self. But like, I was like, we want to Love is Blind baby, And then it cuts to your man from season three who has a baby, who I assume is not with somebody from Love is Blind, but is is that kid not allowed, is, you know, sent to a Love is Blind orphanage because it's both parents aren't from Love is Blind? Like, I don't understand. But like, in the same way, you know, I know how the heterosexual, you know, trajectory of life goes. And it's like the bride is just down at breakfast the day after a wedding. And the mom-in-law is like, so you think of the kids? Like, so that is a real thing. And I guess it's no surprise that this rears its ugly head in this show.
Yeah, I think as much as people want this to be like a really fresh, modern reality TV show and sit in the space alongside things like Married at First Sight, it is American produced, so think The Bachelor and Bachelorette kind of vibe, and it's also Netflix, so it's going to be that extra level of, it just always feels watered down. I just never feel like I'm getting like really good reality TV drama. And there's also been other criticism this week, not just of the reunion, but a lot of stuff that has resurfaced. We actually discussed this last series on Don't Quote Me, and it's come up again. Last year we discussed about a contestant on the second series who sued Netflix over an alleged breach of labor laws, and said the producers encouraged the cast to drink alcohol while limiting their access to food and water and underpaying them. He was seeking, I think, unpaid wages and compensation for like missed meals and rest periods, as well as like therapy, I think. Obviously, the production company denied all of this. But since that, another season two cast member, Danielle, who Manny will remember from her relationship with Nick, has alleged that after telling producers that she didn't feel mentally stable enough to continue filming the program, that she was talked into staying alongside her partner, Nick, at the time. She even, and trigger warning here ahead of this conversation, she even recalled experiencing panic attacks and suicidal thoughts during filming and said that, I kept telling them, I don't trust myself. I'm having these thoughts. I don't think I can continue in this situation. Now, producers have responded to these allegations, saying that the show has rigorous protocols in place for the care of cast members. The well-being of our participants is of paramount importance. We have rigorous protocols in place to care for each person before, during, and after filming. I'm very much a person like, there's no smoke without fire. And this feels like quite a few contestants from many different series coming forward with similar types of complaints, basically that they are not, fundamentally, they're not being cared for in the way that they felt like they should have been. And I mean, we've seen this kind of stuff. I mean, not even this kind of complaints about Love Island and ITV. We've never had such kind of direct attacks at the show and our producers. It's never been to this extent. And we've seen even that impact on the show and how much duty of care has become part of the terminology around Love Island now. What do you think? How do you think a show comes back from this kind of criticism? Like, surely this is like nail in the coffin kind of stuff.
Yeah, but the other part of me thinks is like, this is going to be bound to happen. Like, you know, Love Island being, I guess, a lingua franca amongst the two of us, be like, you know, you are, especially women, but like, you men as well, you are aligning their self-worth with, you know, compatibility with, you know, being in a relationship. And this show is just that on steroids. And it's like, the only way I'll get any sort of airtime or get any chance at love is if I find somebody in this pod and get engaged and commit my life to them. But I don't really know, you know, it's such a stressful thing to do. And I'm sure the people who say they're in love are in love, even though I did, Nick Lachey again, we turned to, I think it was Brett and Tiffany. So are you guys still happily married at this point? Which is like, I mean, we know they're all going to divorce at some stage, but listen, are you happily married?
Right now in the room.
Well, Nick, you don't even believe in the process. I don't know. I find it very hard to have a duty of care. Yeah, I just feel it's juxtaposed to the idea of the show, which is quote, an experiment that's forcing people to make huge life decisions at a whim, hoping they'll pay off.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I just think there's something about this idea that they've all gone through, you know, this, you know, in these interviews and this testing before to find kind of a group of compatible people, and they have to figure out then whatever. But it's like, it's not even adding that kind of stuff to the mix as much as Married at First Sight does, where they kind of talk about, you know, well, we put A and B together because they both said A, you know, 1, 2, 3 is important to them. X, Y, Z is important to them. And that is a commonality that means that we're going to think they could be a good match. Now, I don't believe that they do that with all couples. I'm absolutely eyes open to the fact that some couples are a disaster waiting to happen and they're happy to put them in an apartment and see how it goes. But Love is Blind is just a little bit more, it feels like they're all individually casted. They're all individually kind of assessed to what seems to be a fairly relaxed level of assessment according to other contestants.
Yeah.
And then they're all put into this space where they're told, yeah, either you find someone or you will get potentially less airtime than someone on Snatch Game this year on RuPaul's Drag Race. Like, as in, you literally will be like, out of there. You're out of there. Like, it's crazy. So the pressure is then on for you to force a connection, to find something to grasp to stay on this show that you've already given up months of time to this testing and interviewing and auditioning and all this stuff. Like, I don't know, understand how people don't see that it's doomed to fail. Like, there is one successful couple that everyone loves from season one. And I'm like, yeah, but like, Love Island has loads of successful couples in comparison, but yet the standard that it's held to is quite different to Love is Blind. And I just find that quite interesting.
Can I ask about this season? There seem to be two couples who got together that didn't get together in the pods. Zach and Bliss and Jackie and Josh.
Yes.
How did they cover that in the show? Like, how did Zach and Bliss... So it seemed to be Josh and Jackie met in a coffee shop. Where did, how did Zach and Bliss meet?
So they all met in, the pods, but they were all, they all did not pick each other in the pods to be there, whatever. So Zach and Bliss had work kind of, you know, dating in the pods, and then he picked Arena instead. So that ended his relationship with Bliss. And like, and likewise, Jackie picked Marshall. Thank you, Kim. Picked Marshall in the pods and ditched Josh, and then they came back. So basically, they like, Zach wasn't happy with Irina. He went and like kind of fought for Bliss, and Jackie wasn't happy with Marshall, and she went and pursued Josh. So that's,
but this is after the pod, post-pods.
Post-pods, yeah.
So in my opinion, shouldn't be on the show. If you get engaged in the pods and then you break up, you're not on the show anymore.
You're gone. You're gone.
And then what blew my mind was, so I was like, so you're telling me, Zach, you proposed to Irina, didn't work out because she's a bully, which we can get to. Then you bump into Bliss somewhere and you're like, Joe, you know, filming's wrapping up in 2 weeks. Let's get engaged and get married.
Yeah.
I was like, are you fucking serious?
Yeah.
Like, whatever about I've agreed to this thing, I'll get married because I signed up to it. You know, let's just embrace the experiment. Why would you subsequently do it afterwards? Like, at least with Josh and Jackie, they were like, we're just going to take our relationship at a normal pace now because we're not confined to this stupid show.
Yeah. And it's funny because Zach and Bliss have become probably one of the most favorited couples from this series. Like, people are really, really rooting for them, especially after the reunion.
Did you see the big picture of the owls in their house?
Oh, stop. I can't.
Look, I felt bad for them because I would hate a camera crew around my house. So, I wrote down the quote, which was, there was somebody talking about their chairs. Oh, these chairs are giving me life. Look at my cool shelf. It was all a bit desperate. But I was like, you know, if I'd just moved in somewhere, I wouldn't know what to say about my house either. But that, the big owls
blown
up on the wall of two owls, and he serenaded her with this AI generated song.
Not ChatGPT coming through for the win.
It was honestly, I was like, you know, don't be cynical, Keen, and I was I just had to laugh and go, this is, these are not my, we don't say love languages, me and that.
No, the tours, I just think that they, Netflix demands so much buy-in to these couples. And I'm like, no. Because at least with other shows, like, again, Married at First Sight is a really natural comparison. There is a real understanding that this is not quite real until the end. Like, and at the end, then it's like, let's see. But there's also an understanding that once the show is over, that it's not a done deal. Like, this isn't forever. Like, we hope and all this kind of stuff, if they've kind of committed, we hope. But, like, it's not a done deal. Whereas, for some reason, Netflix tries to convince us that Love is Blind is like, that's it, that they found their person. That's it. That's done. Like, let's wrap. And it's like, what? Like, no, half of these people are not going to even be talking to each other in a year's time. Like, what? Like, it just is a frustrating watch for me. I don't ever feel like I get really good quality drama or like really romantic moments or decent hosts who can ask decent questions. I just find it stressful, to be honest. And I'm glad it's over for another year.
How did you feel about Irina on her apology brigade?
I mean, it was bullshit. It was all a pre-prepared line. I mean, everything that Vanessa or Nick would mention outside of what she had delivered in her speech, she was like, oh, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to speak on that. And it's like literally referring to her notes being like, oh yeah, shit, that was another thing that I wanted to cover. Mm. It just felt so disingenuous. And I just, as much as I have so much sympathy for her and Micah and other people who have absolutely faced the wrath of social media, like it's brutal. I'm also like, you did what you did. And if you come on and take real accountability, grand, but like, it just didn't feel very real. I don't know. And then it's like, can you call bullshit on it? Like maybe it felt more performative because that's what she needed to do to like keep herself together or like keep it. So I don't know.
It kind of reminded me of 2000s reality TV.
Yeah.
That, like Katie, what's her name? UK
Piper? No, Katie.
I'm glad we could. I didn't hear it because I was talking about it, but I actually don't want to hear her name again. But you know, we're talking about The Apprentice, and you know, then reality and awful, hateful Tory. And then like Omarosa in the US Apprentice, like these bad girls of reality TV. And like when Vanessa was like, even Irina will be here, that was like pearl clutching from the crowd. I was like,
yeah,
all right, so it's like we're back to this now again, villainizing these women. The true villain of the reunion for me was Paul.
So this was also another discussion about kind of Vanessa and her quote unquote bias, because during the show's run, Paul was very well liked. Micah was actually the one that people were kind of more against. She had a horrible friend who was horrible to Paul and horrible to her, like about Shelby. The situation. Shelby, yes.
I took my notes.
You got your notes. And she, and people really rallied behind Paul all the way through. Micah was seen as like the real villain of the series, even above Irina. Like people were like really against her. And then the reunion came and it seemed as if Vanessa sided with Micah a little bit and just kind of drilled Paul a little bit more. And usually I like that in a reunion. Usually I like that kind of let's flip it and like, let's try and actually get, like, let's not just put the person who is clearly in the wrong here, like on, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. On absolute blast. Like, let's try and kind of get some more nuance to the situation. But it felt like she had in a bar of Paul, that she was just like, no, I don't think what he did is right. So therefore I'm giving Micah a pass. I just wish he had vocalized his feelings a little bit better. I know the big thing was him saying that he didn't feel like Micah would make a good, not a good mother, but he couldn't see her being a mother. And spoke a lot about how she wasn't nurturing. And I think what he was trying to say was, I can't see myself having children with her. And that I think was like, it was bad, but it was an okay thing to feel about a relationship. Everything he said was like this messy character attack, like just like anti-feminist, like just gross rambling, and it was like, it was awful to watch.
I was fuming. I just was like, how dare somebody weaponize nurturing against women? Like, it's so difficult. It, like, it feeds back to the thing, which is like, oh, she, you know, she had some casual sex and she twerked on a table, she's not fit to be a mother. It's like, no, you know, mothers can do anything that non-mothers can do, because, and they still be a good mother. It was, and then like his, I've realized it's not because she can't be a good mother, I just never gave her the space to. And I was like, no, that's bullshit. The correct answer to this is, I don't think we're compatible parents. That's your only get out of jail card, and you blew it.
That's it. And and that, it almost felt like he was trying to say something with good intent with that comment of, you know, maybe I didn't support her enough. And it was just like, I get that you think that that is, but that is not the compliment you think that is. Like, you, that is not the gentlemanly thing that you think you've said. What you've actually said is something like quite sexist and quite patronizing to her as her own person. Mm-hmm. And it was, I didn't hate Micah as much as many viewers did. Like, I really don't get that invested in Love is Blind to like hate people or like really dislike them.
Yeah.
I think she had a few really poor moments, but I think she handled herself really well at the reunion. Like, for someone who was going in there a villain, I think she handled it really well.
Yeah, I didn't get the villain vibes off her based on the edit I saw just in this episode. So
There you go. Let's move on to something that has been, should have been dominating my social media feed for the last couple of weeks and just has not been, and what that might mean and all the conversations that are going on around it. Coachella, is it entering its flop era? Oh. I ask you, Kian, what do you think?
Well, this year is definitely a flop. Poor Frank Ocean. I have a picture of him right over my laptop when I'm talking to you right here. Love Frank Ocean. But I get, I think it's just, you know, things, fashion is transitory, you know, we things come in and out of fashion. I remember being in school and, you know, I used to love Nick Grimshaw and he was over Coachella hanging out with Katy Perry. And I was like, oh, I wish I could do that. Like, so, you know, like that's the festival I want to go to. And then I went to my J1 and I was like basically asking everyone, have you been to Coachella? Have you been to Coachella? And they were like, well, actually, there's lots of festivals. There's like Bonnaroo. And I was like, no, I want to go to Coachella.
Don't care.
But yeah, now, like, I think the last good thing that came out of Coachella is that Beyonce performance. Ever since the Ariana Grande performance, I think, there was like overshadowed by it, money from Chick-fil-A or something went to pay for it. You just have these you just know of Leonardo DiCaprio picking up his next 19-year-old girlfriend.
Oh, God.
It's like, you know, it's just become influencer con on steroids. And it's now kind of like pastiche and twee and just not it.
Yeah, I really think you're right about Beyonce. I think Homecoming, Beyonce headliner, was like the pinnacle of its influence. I remember watching, and there was a string of Irish influencers at it that year, and I remember being glued to their stories, which I'm not normally. Like, I'm not a person to like follow people like that in a way, but it was like, anything they put up, I want to see, because I knew they were going to Beyonce. I knew they were like, you know, gung-ho on seeing it and being as close to the stage. And it was like this real anticipation. And even still, I watch Homecoming on Netflix, like when I'm getting ready for a night out, or I just need to feel like energized. Like, it's literally one of the most amazing live performances for that kind of energy boost. But I think since then, it's just kind of lost. And I think that in tandem with like TikTok and this new generation of influencer and what it means to be an influencer and the value that they have and the kind of currency that moves in that space is just different. And I think Coachella is a really big victim of that, because it really leaned on that environment. It really leaned on that kind of ecosystem of influencer culture to kind of bolster what was in itself a really impressive music festival with a really impressive lineup musically, but also to create this like pop culture moment. It really leveraged like influencer culture. And I think because that has changed so much, you're seeing Coachella now kind of not be this like lust worthy. Cause I remember the years, like people like Nick Grimshaw, people like Rita Ora, like all these like English stars going over and like hanging out with A-list Hollywood royalty in like really chic festival outfits, like making such effort for the looks, and it was like all part of the experience. I mean, now you're seeing celebrities turn up in like literally jeans and like denim jackets, and I'm like, I'm happy for you, but like people are not arsed.
But I think what you're getting at there is kind of interesting. It's you know, influencers were a revolution to the advertising space when they came through, and with the dawn of Instagram, and you're kind of seeing that disruption again with TikTok. I mean, I've friends with like Gen Z siblings and stuff who say things like, you know, Gen Z people don't want one person to have all the fame. They want one person to be good at this and that's it. You know, if we know you for doing lip syncs to The Simpsons, we don't want you selling makeup. Like, you know, that seems to be the mentality, is stick to your lane and stop trying to diversify your brand. And I think, you know, this could be a casualty of it, which is like the kids don't really care about this Instagram festival anymore. The other thing is the lineup. I was trying to find the Friday. I couldn't see who the Friday headliner was. Blackpink, I think, do have a lot of Gen Z followers. Yeah. Frank Ocean's last album was in 2016, which is 7 years ago. So anyone who's like 14, 15, 16 on TikTok was 9 max when that came out. And like the other sort of big name people were excited for was J. Paul, who released like his music was released on blogs. That is, you know, it gives you a timestamp of like when he was popular. And as for people who are in the 30s or late 20s or early, you know, that's the sort of music that they have nostalgia for and they're excited for. And they're the people maybe that are going to Coachella. But like, you'd want some sort of like TikTok rapper that like, you know, it was like Lizzie McAlpin or whatever, like to be headlining or something for those kids to want to go to it.
Those damn ceilings kids.
Yeah. You know, someone like that who's kind of blow up or like, I mean, I don't, TikTok's probably the wrong person to talk about this, but it's like, even their lineup was geared towards a certain audience as well. So,
and it's hard, right? Because like, Not Lizzie McAlpin, because obviously she is touring, but like these kind of TikTok artists who, you know, have this moment of like virality on TikTok or on various platforms with either it be, you know, an audio clip like Ceilings, that hook that everyone was out running to, or whether it be like a full song or whether it be a trend, a dance trend or something. They have this moment of virality and that doesn't necessarily always translate to a live touring act. It doesn't necessarily translate to someone who can A, put on like a full hour long, 2 hour long set, because they might not even have that amount of music. But B, that the audience is also so different. Like conversion in those audiences is so different to what it was like with us, with millennials. I mean, it was like, we finally had a gateway to all of this stuff. And you had someone telling you that, you know, this was, you should get this. And it was like a seal of approval for you to say, okay, I'm going to get it. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go here. I'm going to do this experience, whatever. Mm-hmm. That access is so much broader now. It's so much more, you know, up to date. It's, and this culture of like de-influencing and all that, like translating a TikTok viral song into a sellout tour or a sellout Coachella headliner set is like, it's a different thing. And I feel like, can Coachella adapt to become what it was for millennials in the kind of 2012 to like 2016, 17 for Gen Zs? I just don't know. And I mean, as much as Frank Ocean, like you said, mightn't be someone who many Gen Z ticket holders would be aware of, the absolute flop of his performance will be something that they remember, even if he has very little relevance to them. Just a little bit of context for anyone who has been in a cave the last week. Frank Ocean was headlining both weekends of Coachella. He took to the main stage on the first weekend an hour late. He is said to have performed mostly the entire concert, sitting down with his back to the audience. Various audience members pointed out on Twitter that he had been lip syncing apparently at certain points in his set, which didn't feature some of his most popular songs. And it also was abruptly ended at the end due to the curfew restrictions in the area, which are rack up like hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines for Coachella every year for going over by like 10-15 minutes. I think his set went over by like 25 minutes and it cost them like $120,000 or something to pay those fines. But yeah, so that was kind of last weekend. Then this week we heard that he had pulled out of the second weekend due to quote unquote sustaining a leg injury on festival grounds in the week leading up to the weekend. Frank Ocean was unable to perform the intended show on weekend one, but was still intent on performing. And in 72 hours, the show was reworked out of necessity. He has since pulled out of weekend two. So this was obviously a huge story to come out of the first weekend. And had a lot of people talking. There was loads of videos of people rushing through the gates as they opened to get kind of front row from Frank Ocean. Loads of videos of people leaving prematurely. As a fan, what did you make of what you saw?
Of the people or of the performance?
Of the performance and the fallout from it. Did you think it was fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think like Frank Ocean is a critical darling. He's not known for his live performances. He rarely performs live. He has a good voice, but like how well does it perform to a live performance? I watched bits of it. You know, I kind of personally feel, and this is a kind of a separate conversation, the best thing about a concert is being surrounded by people who love the music you do. And I wonder, like, even if the person is shit, like you're singing your favorite songs with the other people around you. But one thing that I think he did that would really piss audiences off is that he didn't sing the studio versions. He like ad-libbed and changed like the format of the song. So like you think it's a chorus and then he just ends it, and like that would piss you off. So I can totally understand why, being there, I'd be annoyed. And I probably was like, well, look, I saw him. Grand, I can tick that off the list. But I'm also not surprised.
Yeah.
I don't think that's his thing. He seems to have done it because he recently lost his brother in a car accident, I think, if I can remember. And his brother and him really loved Coachella. And it kind of got the vibes he was doing this for his brother. Like, his brother would find it really cool. He was headlining Coachella. And in the first night, he kind of does a little speech about his brother and how much his brother would find this was cool. And I mean, the whole crowd, the 40,000 people or wherever many people were there, were like, you could hear a pin drop. And that goes to show kind of the reverence people had. But yeah, I mean, you know, when you're up against the same, when you're in the same slot as Beyonce, you know, you've got big boots to fill. And I'm not surprised he didn't do the second week, because he probably just spent the whole week looking at all the hatred and disappointment and think pieces that they had in his performance. And he was like, fuck, this is why I don't do this. I'm not doing
it. Yeah. Yeah. I think it started an interesting conversation during the week about, you know, there was a lot of people who came out in support of him. I know Justin Bieber released a statement talking about how impressed he was by the artistry of the set. There were other kind of fairly notable celebrities who came out in support of him. And it made me think of, and not just me, I know loads of people had this moment, and it was very much discussed on my Twitter timeline anyway, about the comparison to Rihanna's Super Bowl performance and the criticism of, you know, her not putting on a quote unquote show. Like, you know, the costuming was boring. She wasn't dancing enough. She wasn't this, that, and the other enough. And I just think it was like so jarringly obvious what that was about. Like, it just felt like such an unfair standard to be set for her just based on her gender, because, like, let's call a spade, that's what it was about. Like, that kind of demand is never put on male performers. And like, this is a perfect example. I mean, this will die down for him. But if Rihanna got up and did something like this for the Super Bowl, that'd be it. Like, that would literally be it for her. Like, it's just interesting how quickly people were to jump in, people of kind of note to jump in and be like, this is his artistry. This is him as a performer. He's not a live performer. That's not his thing. Like, and that's a good explanation for why maybe this was the way it was, but also why was that not also used for Rihanna? Like, this idea that, like, she's at a different point in her life. She's not the performer she used to be. She wants to do things like this. She's low key, like, all that stuff. I thought that was really an interesting difference.
I think it is interesting. My counterpoint to that would be, when you have a headline slot, you can do it whichever way you want to do, which I suppose is your point. Why are people annoyed at Frank Ocean? But I think with the Super Bowl, for me anyway, as a raging fag, I want to see big dance numbers. And I'm disappointed if I don't get it from Rihanna, and I'm disappointed if I don't get it from Dr. Dre. Like, I'm just disappointed if I don't get it, regardless of who it is from. But whereas, I think that's the gig. And if you're doing the gig, I think you need to play ball. When you're headlining Coachella, you can
Was that a sports pun? Love it.
Unintentionally.
I get, like, what you're saying. Coachella is more your time to do of it what you will.
More of a blank canvas.
Super Bowl is kind of an expected type of performance, I guess.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. I think it's interesting. I think also, like, I mean, for me, the style of Coachella used to be a huge draw, like for me, Instagram has always been kind of, that's where I kind of started, was like that era of like Coachella influence, like floral crowns and all of the vice grips that they had on us. Like, that has also kind of dissipated. Like, I just don't see Coachella being this like lustworthy thing. Like, I remember years ago waiting for, like, I don't know, someone like Variety or someone to start posting like the celebrity pictures of who was there and what they were wearing and who they were going to see. And like, honestly, I literally didn't even know half the people that were performing until like TikTok forced it down my neck. And I was like, oh, okay, grand. I didn't even realize it was on this weekend. Okay, fine. Like, whatever. It's just not the same buzz.
But also, Coachella has never innovated in its style. Like, you go to any festival in the country and there's people in flower crowns. Like, flower crowns, like, its influence has influenced every festival in the world.
Yeah.
But it never moves the gauge to be like, oh, this new style that everyone's wearing in Coachella is, you know, dressing like a gas casket or something, like, I don't know, something else. You know, it just was like, we've invented the fire clown and that's it. We've done our part. So they didn't manage to reinvent the wheel there.
Yeah. Someone who is having cultural reference beyond what I ever thought possible, Drew Barrymore. This is not so much of like a news headline as more of a discussion piece on her and her sudden, like, constant virality thanks to her show, these constant clips of her having these deep heart to hearts while sat on the floor with various A-list celebrities about really, really traumatic, deep stuff, and how she has just kind of cemented herself as like whatever kind of queen of daytime title that is up for grabs since Ellen DeGeneres was pushed out the back door. Like, it's mad how she has just grown in this space in the last 2 years.
Yeah, I used to watch clips of a show. I end up watching more clips of Kelly Clarkson's show, who I definitely think is worth adding into this mix of conversation. Yeah. But I think basically their secret sauce is very similar. They are both exuberant, goofy, nurturing, unlike Micah. You know, presenters who are kind of like unprofessional by that. Is it like, you know, it's not the stiff upper lip. It isn't like, it's like, you know, there's that clip of Kelly Clarkson and Colin Farrell where they keep talking over each other. And it's just this really kind of crazy energy.
Yeah.
And as the viewer, you feel like because the host is as famous as the guest, you feel like you're kind of backstage. You kind of like you're privy to these conversations that you wouldn't normally hear. And like, it's not like Graham Norton, who's there asking the questions, getting the stories out of the guests. You're getting a bit of Drew. You're getting a bit of Hugh Grant. You're getting kind of double anecdote for your money. And I think that's really what makes it so compelling.
Yeah. And I think, again, not to link everything to TikTok, but I think, again, like, you know, TikTok being a platform that is like so about kind of casual filming and it's not uber professional and brand ads are not welcome on the platform and it's everyone can be whatever. I think this style of daytime TV is quite similar in that lane, in that it's like you said, it's not, they're not super professional. They're not super slick at hosting. They're not super slick interviewers by the kind of classic sense, but instead they use their status in the community that both them and the guests are a part of to put that person at ease. And like you say, yeah, it just always feels like you're listening in on like secrets being spilled. And I mean, Drew has gotten some incredible moments on her show, specifically in the last kind of 6 to 8 months. The show launched in September 2020. So it's been on the air now for about 2.5 years. And I mean, she has just continued to pull in high profile guest after high profile guest, and had these really intimate moments on the show. I mean, the interview with Brooke Shields went viral everywhere in the last couple of weeks when they spoke about just like the abuses of the movie industry and how them as young girls and children working in that space before Me Too and before all of that stuff, what that was like, what, you know, powers were at play and what powers did they feel like they didn't have. And I just think that kind of interview, I mean, Brooke Shields was doing press at the time for her book. For her documentary movie and or her book, sorry. And
but both, I think, thinking about the same, no, both coming out around the same time, weren't they?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But like, she would not have had that conversation in that way with that much honesty and that much like just darkness with anybody else than someone like Drew, who could just be like sit on the floor with her and totally empathize with what her experience was, because it was also quite similar to what Drew apparently experienced. It's just wild to watch it when you think of like even just Ellen DeGeneres, like the predecessor just before, a different vibe entirely.
Yeah. And you know, I saw similar with Jeanette McCurdy. I think there's a very similar balance there, where Drew seems to be learning about herself in front of you, and look, you know, she could just be recreating what she's learned from reading the book or blah blah blah, which, you know, she does, you know, at the end of the day, she is an actress and she can sell her role as this fawning TV host. And I think what Drew does really well is because the clips that I see of her tend to be more with actors, famous actors, and I think because she's an actor, she does a great job of when it gets kind of inside baseball, she goes, and by the way, audience, you know, when we do a shoot, it's like this and like this, but when you were there, it blah blah blah, blah, and like,
yeah,
you know, it's broken down easy for you and you can follow, and you kind of, you also respect her opinion as an actor who's been there, who's been a producer, who's seen it all, more than you might do Graham Norton, who's kind of just more of a media guy.
Yeah.
I think I don't necessarily think TikTok is the reason this is successful. I think this is just more a general move away from chat TV to it being more compassionate. I think you get with Kelly and with Drew a more compassionate interview. It seems to be kind of, I don't want to say pseudo-psychology, but like there is a lot of sort of mantras in it. And I don't even say that's a bad thing about it. It's like they're going in there to discuss like how, you know, how they live their life. And it's a very RuPaul style of interviewing. It's sort of like, talk to me about, you know, what motivates you and therapy and stuff like that. It's kind of more maybe Oprah. And Ellen would. Ellen is kind of more in the style of the late night shows, the Jimmys. Yeah. Which is kind of like pranks. And I was watching Kelly, Kelly Clarkson does a game which is named that intro, but you have to sing the intro. And there's that clip of Anne Hathaway who sung Since You've Been Gone before Kelly. And then I watched Taylor Swift play basically the same game with Jimmy Fallon.
Yes.
And Jimmy Fallon set it up so that he would get Shake It Off before Taylor. And I was like, that's basically, it's the same joke. Mm. But when one of them, Kelly as the host, makes herself the victim, and then the other one, Jimmy, makes the guest the victim.
Yeah.
I think that's a perfect example of the evolution of the chat show format, in that it's full of compassion for the guest. And I think that opens up and gets more gold out of them.
Yeah. And I mean, I think if you think about it, we've discussed that on this podcast quite a few times before about like paparazzi culture and like pop culture media in like the 2010s versus now, and how there was a real narrative of, you know, let's drag those people down to prove that they're just like us. And that was the mentality. And yeah, like these talk shows were like that. I mean, we've all seen the clips of Ellen DeGeneres grilling Taylor Swift on what guy she would like to be with. And Taylor Swift is clearly uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And but it was like, you know, inviting the audience in to laugh at the celebrity to even the playing field. Whereas your Drew Barrymore's and your Kelly Clarkson's, they feel a little bit more like, you know, we don't have to bring this person down to feel like they're like us. This is why they're like us. And it doesn't have to be at the expense of their, you know, their pride or whatever. They can just choose to let us in if the invite is coming from the right place. And I think they've really nailed it. I mean, even the silly games, I know Kelly does quite a few of those like musical games, which I just find tedious on the late night stuff, like the carpool karaoke's and the, I know Jimmy Fallon does like 20,000 of them because he just loves.
Now, my YouTube rabbit hole did end me to a mixtape mashup between Kelly Clarkson and Ariana Grande doing like pop diva classics. And by the end of it, I was crying.
Yes. They're great. And Kellyoke is great.
Yes.
The musical intros. I know she did one with Niall Horan recently, which was amazing. Like, again, it just feels so much more natural and less cringe because she is a respected and critically acclaimed artist that is worthy of singing with like some of the biggest musical talent of, you know, 2023. And it just reads so much more authentic than any of that other like nonsense.
Yeah. Okay. I've got three things to say. I don't know which one I want to say first. On the first point, I think they are so instead of Ellen belittling the person to make them feel like us, I think what Kelly and Drew are doing is they're approaching the guest with the same sort of fangirly attitudes that we would have. So they are like representing us plebs towards this, like Drew Barrymore is always such big doe-eyed excitement towards Hugh Grant or Ben Affleck, or like throws his head back, oh, Jennifer Lopez, she's such a goddess. Like, that's how we get access to them. And then that disarms the guest, and you kind of feel like you're having almost like a meet and greet via Drew Barrymore, which I think is her magic. The late night thing did you mention Kelly Clarkson and Niall Horan? Did you see the clip recently where Niall Horan told James Corden he's been saying his name wrong?
I did see this. Yeah.
And James Corden doubles down and says, no, I haven't. You've got your name wrong. Which I just was like, look, I actually didn't believe. I was like, I don't know why people hate James Corden so much. Like, I, you know, he's not great, but I don't hate him. After I saw that clip, 14 years too late, I'm on board.
I know. I legit could do a whole true crime series on why there are many reasons that I hate James Corden. And it started.
I want to hear it. You and Jenny Claffey get together, bedroom that shit.
I'm pretty sure I've said this on here before, but he did an interview when he moved over to the US first with Stephen Colbert on his late night talk show. And I think he was about a year into the Late Late Show with James Corden. And Stephen Colbert asked him on the podcast or on his chat show, you know, you've obviously been in America now for a year. Like, do you think of yourself as more of an American or more of a British person? Stupid question, right? Like a stupid question. Mm-hmm. This is like a 36-year-old man who has grown up and lived in the UK his whole life. His most of his
years.
Career.
1 year most, in the US. Yeah.
Most of his career has been based on creating incredibly English, British characters and for incredibly British shows. And like, he has really leaned into that. Like, he has really leaned into that, like, I'm an English geezer vibe. And James Corden comes back and he says, oh, I just think of myself as a citizen of the world, really. Like, I just don't see borders and countries. I just was like, no, absolutely not. I'm not doing it. You have sold us your narrative of being a proud English man your whole career, and that is fine. Don't now go to the US and be like we're all one, like kumbaya, like there's no bother. I was just like, no.
If I don't take it from people who've been backpacking in Thailand with a bindi and some parachute pants, I'm not taking it from you.
No. It was like that guy who went viral on TikTok, the other Irish guy who was like, it was like, where are you from? And he was like, oh, I should say Ireland, but I'm really this. Oh, I need to dig up that clip. It was fucking jokes. But yeah.
The other thing I wanted to say though on Kelly though is,
yeah,
I think her career is so interesting because she rises to fame in American Idol. By all accounts, she was clearly the winner, but she was such like a normal day girl and she was able to sing other people's songs with such like versatility.
Yeah.
She has her own career. She gets fucked over by the industry. She, you know, gets forced to work with Dr. Luke. She doesn't want to blah, 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 blah. She now is going through a divorce. And how she's claiming back her A-star status is again by singing other people's songs in front of America. And I think that's a really interesting symmetry to her career.
Yeah, 100%. And I think even seeing her, like I'm a sucker for the voice interview or the voice auditions. Oh my God, I love it so much. If I've had a bad day, I'm like, I need to watch some voice knockout rounds. Like I just need it. And she's so brilliant on that as well. Mm-hmm. Just such an empathetic person, like really coming at it from like, I have experienced this. I've experienced the highs and the really bad lows. And like, here's what we're going to do. And she's just funny, and Drew is the same. Mm-hmm. And it's just wild to watch them, because I remember when their shows were announced, I think Kelly was announced like 6 months before Drew, and then Drew came, and I was like, Jesus, this has got to wash out as quickly as half of these kind of you know, the Kris Jenner show and all these chat shows that pop up for a season and disappear. But these two seem to be really, I mean, hanging on in there. I mean, I'm seeing kind of Jennifer Hudson and clips from her show and a few others, and I'm like, oh, I leave it or I'm not arsed. This stuff seems to be really like hitting the right nail on the right
head. And I don't know, like, I don't know the American TV system well enough to know, are they on the same time? Are they on the same channel? Are they competing? What networks, like, is Wendy Williams still on? I think she is.
No, she's gone.
Is she? She gone for good?
Yeah, she's gone. She's gone for good, yeah.
I remember watching Michelle Visage and Leah Remini, like, host her show when she was off. But she's gone for good now. Is she? Okay, I'm not sure. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, she's gone for good now. It's Sherry, your one who used to be on The View, Sherry Shepherd, is that her name?
Okay.
She's taken over. It's very similar. There's quite a lot of the like Hot Topics type segments, as far as I know, still there. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's having the same kind of cultural impact that the Wendy Williams show had in its kind of heyday. But yeah, it just seems like potential. And like, I mean, again, there seems to be endless room for endless chat shows hosted by men, but there's that space is always a little bit smaller when it's women. So I think when you have two people who are doing it really well, like Drew Barrymore and Kelly Clarkson, it must make it hard for other people in that space to try and grab some of that audience.
And sure, won't we have a female-led talk show now ourselves come September?
Is this confirmed?
No, but like, I mean,
lads, to say I don't give a fuck about who hosts the Late Late Show in Ireland. You could
care if it's the right person and they do the good job. Like,
I mean, maybe, yeah, but I just don't give a fuck. And like, the news websites in Ireland are just horny to tease every little fucker who has said anything about it on their Twitter in the last 10 years. And I'm just like, honestly, I don't care.
It's like the conversation about who's going to be the next Bond, you know?
Just exhausting. Exhausting. I don't care. Like, I just don't
care. Well, I said this on Louise McSherry's podcast. She disagreed with me, but I'm here for Angela Scanlon. I want her to do it.
I mean, it seems like it should go to her, right? Like, Ask Me Anything is proving popular. I think it's just back for another series. But I just don't know if they'll give it to someone like Angela Scanlon, who's not like a, you know, a pillar of Irish broadcasting, yeah. you know, like, mm-hmm. but she feels like she would be new and fresh. But I guess it must be hard for RTE when they know they have this pressure of like the longest running talk show in the world.
Yeah.
And the legacy that that has. And so many people do kind of, you know, map their mm-hmm. diary around various late specials and toy shows and like Valentine's Day and country mm-hmm. episodes and all this nonsense. So like,
actually, the two of us would grab an opportunity to go to the Late Late Show. Like, sure.
I'd absolutely whore myself out as well. If they invite me on, I'd be like, oh, it's such an honor. Oh, God. But I just don't care about all this. Before we go, we want to talk quickly about some of the stuff that we've been loving this week. I mentioned it quite a bit. I'll just get it out of the way nice and quickly. Married at First Sight Australia, absolutely hitting the nail on the head again this season. There is, I believe, 1 week left of the main show, and then we have reunions on Channel 4, and it is just perfection. Frustrating, funny, stressful, cliffhangy, all what you want from like good reality TV. And it's one of those shows that just for me, it never misses the mark for like drama. I'm always gutted when I realize it's only on for like 4 days a week and I have to wait till Monday to see it again. Just great. I know you're not a fan though, Cian, because of previously discussed reasons.
But like, does the fact you're getting married soon impact your viewing of it?
I don't think
but you don't go, maybe I'll have that for my wedding, or like, I guess it's not really about the wedding though, is it? It's
no
about
after. So the first marriage that they have at the start is not legally binding.
Okay.
So when they, it's more of like a symbolic ceremony, but it's not legally binding.
Okay.
It's kind of, they don't organize it. So like production organizes it to kind of mirror the couples. Like there's two of the youngest ever participants this year and they're both like 26. So they had like a Gen Z wedding with loads of like neon lights and like, you know, it was in the dark and it was just weird. It was like, okay, this is what you think.
Like, yeah, what did you think, Jen? Did you watch the Sex and the City spin-off and Just Like That?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember Rock's TikTok? My name is Rock, the new kid on the block. Like, never has anything been so desperately off target for Gen Z audience.
Oh, than my
those 50-year-olds writing that Gen Z TikTok.
It's so poor, isn't it? It's so transparent. And you could see it on this as well. It was just like, oh, you've just gotten a few like LOL, you know, neon signs and shoved them up on a wall or something. Yeah. And it's like, oh, God.
That video of Rock is my voice. Is my voice YouTube videos. When I'm having a bad day, I'm like, let's see Rock come out in school via TikTok. And then Rose so knows the dance for it already, and they do
so bad, so bad. But yeah, so it's not inspiring like wedding. Yeah, it's not like, I'm not adding it to my like Pinterest board or whatever. But yeah, those first weddings aren't legally binding, and then they work through the process for like 3 months, and then they have what's called like final vows, and then that's when they're like meant to like promise each other that they want to commit. But again,
so like Love is Blind, they might not do it by the end.
They might not do it by the end, and people leave every week as you move through it. Okay. So they choose every week if they want to stay or they want to leave, and they show it on a little card, and then they go home. And if one person in the couple wants to stay, then both of them have to stay for another week and all this kind of stuff. I think it's, the structure of it is far more juicy than the structure of Love is Blind. I think it makes way more sense. It has way more anticipation. It has way more, you know, risk and reward. And this series has just been
Now that you've explained the format to me a bit more, I'm not as against it, because I'm like, okay, well, they haven't got married and it just is like, they don't have to get married, it's 3 months. So,
and they go there's no host, they go every week to a commitment ceremony where they speak to relationship experts. Now the relationship experts are definitely also TV producers, but they are relationship experts as well. So they do give them like lots of like tools and feedback. And, you know, sometimes you see couples in like a really bad spot, and then they go in and they're like a likable couple, but they're really not working. They have a session with the experts, and then they really work on it the next week. And then they're like, it worked. We're over this like thing. And then sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes they're like, we just couldn't get past it. It's not right. So we're going to leave. I think you would enjoy it a lot more than Love is Blind, because Love is Blind seems a little bit more like, oh, fuck the, you know, fuck the practicalities. Let's just go for it. It makes great telly. Married at First Sight a little bit more acknowledges the fact that like, this is kind of mad. Not everyone's going to agree with this. Like, it's definitely unconventional. Some of it's definitely for entertainment and not for relationship building. But like, let's just all, I think it's A1.
I find myself having, and I guess now I'm in my 30s, it's the marriage time of my life. I do find the conversations about it kind of just difficult. I don't know if it's because, like I said, about queers and our accessibility to marriage, or if I'm just cynical or whatever, but it's just, you know, like people talk about it as if it's more important than just going out for 10 years. Like, yeah. And I see the hold that it has on the women in my life. And I'm like, you know, and like how it can, one person's success can make someone else feel bad. When's my time? Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I wish I could shake everybody out of it and just go, if you want to get married for you and celebrate your relationship or get some legal stability, do it for you, not because of all the expectations of society, I guess.
Yeah.
That's the bit that I struggle whenever it's a marriage related show, I suppose.
Yeah. And I guess the conversation is always that little bit different when you're talking about LGBTQ plus couples versus straight couples and all of the stuff that goes along with that. If you're confused as to why that might be, Google it. But yeah, I think it is. It's just different. I mean, I never thought I wanted to get married, not for any like really emotional reason. I just wasn't really arsed. And then I met my partner and I was like, actually, it could be a thing. And then when it happened, it was like, oh, this feels right for me. But like, I never felt like I had to do it or I should do it, or, you know, it would be weird if I didn't. But like, I also know friends who are like, you know, and people in my life who are like, oh, well, we've been together X amount of years. Like, I'd be expecting a ring soon. And it's like,
it just works differently for us, you know?
Yeah.
And you need to come, you know, the whole thing is set up based on a man and a woman, you know, like, when you are either two grooms or two, like, what do you both have best men? Are you not allowed to have bridesmaids? You kind of just feel like you have to reinvent the whole thing by doing it alone.
You're unraveling the whole structure and trying to, which, I mean, I personally am finding it lovely because the central point of it is a point of difference because it's two brides. Every other part of the tradition can then be, we can opt in or opt out. Like, so we can really decide, like, if we want to have any of this stuff, if we want to do it totally our own way, or if we want to take a little bit of that. So I'm kind of liking the freedom that that gives you, that no one is coming to my wedding expecting it to be A, B, C, D, E. Like, it's going to be different from, you know, whatever percentage of weddings they've been at that year, just based on the fact that there are two brides rather than a bride and a groom. And I'm finding that quite freeing, actually. And it's quite fun to not feel that kind of like, be bound by, like, you know, it has to be perfect and it has to be this, that, and the other. It's like, no, like,
yeah. Just... Yeah, I've definitely noticed, like, I met my boyfriend 11 years. I don't get that many when you get married. And I think, like, had we been an opposite sex couple, we would have been getting that from year three.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, maybe not, we would have been 23, but like, do you know what I mean? Like, I think the fact that we're one step away from the traditional heteronormative trajectory works in our favor in some regard.
Yeah.
But yeah, like that there's still, I think that's probably why I'm also not as connected to it.
Yeah. No, I totally know what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like it's your decision, I guess, all the time. But yeah, it's, I hate seeing people who like feel the weight of that clock. And it's like, I understand why you do. Like, it's not silly that you do, but I just wish people didn't feel as bound by that. Marriage
next week, I'm going on a joint hen though as well, so that's exciting.
Oh, exciting. Let me know how you go. We're thinking about doing something like that.
33 people.
Please let me know, because that's what we're kind of thinking. Yeah. And we're like, is this a disaster waiting to happen, or could this be literally one of the best crack nights ever?
And I don't know what it's like with you and your fiance, but it's like in this scenario, it's like, because, you know, queer women and how lesbians can work, it's like all their exes are going as well.
Oh, no, we don't have that problem.
Okay.
I have very few exes, so sorry. Kian, before we go, you have been loving a show that I finished 2 days ago, Beef, on Netflix.
I haven't finished it yet. I have 2 episodes to go. I've heard all the good stuff about it, but I'm really enjoying it. The world that it creates, the vulnerability in the characters. If you haven't seen it, I guess it starts with these the road rage incident between Ali Wong and Steven Yeun, and their characters, and how their lives become intertangled. And I mean, it's from the start anyway, it seems like, you know, they're both sort of on a one way ticket to, you know,
destruction. Like, yeah,
100%. But yeah, it's like really artistically done. It shows a real, you know, element of vulnerability into their psyche, into their self-hatred, into the pressure that they have on them from their parents, from society. It's a really interesting juxtaposition in which Ali Wong's character being the really rich, successful business lady versus the struggling, down on his luck contractor that Stephen Young plays, she has all the power, which you don't normally see the woman have all the power, and she can, you know, he feels like he can't do anything. It's just really fresh and new, and I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, it's really good. And it's that constant kind of tug of war between the two of them, because you get a little bit more context into why the way they are each episode, and then you kind of are siding with one against the other, and then you're siding with, and it's kind of that back and forth. And you've just passed the point where I think it's like episode six, it, like, I didn't realize it was 10 episodes long, and then episode six it kind of took this like really big pivot, and I was like, oh shit, like this is like a whole new space of story that they're kind of opening up now. And then you kind of get into this weird and wild place for like the last few episodes. And yeah, I mean, it's brilliant. They're shorter episodes as well, which I think is like a good plug. Yeah. Like they're like 35 minutes long. So you kind of like you race through it if you want to. It's not a super.
I just finished episode eight and I gasped at the end. Yeah. And I was watching it away and something happened. I was like.
Just scared at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. It's really good. You will not be disappointed by how it ends, I don't think.
Okay.
But text me and let me know if you are, because that would be really interesting take. Ian Sullivan, first episode, season two. I'm really glad we did this. I've had a good time. I know you don't like half of these shows, but I'm really glad that you invested for the sake of this, okay? Thank you so much to Ciarán Sullivan for joining me on this, the first episode of season two of Don't Quote Me. Thank you to you guys for tuning in each and every week. We hope you're back with us for another season. You can find us on social media at don'tquoteme.podcast. You can also find us on all of your favorite podcast apps, so you can listen whenever and wherever you like. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode and all of the latest pop culture news. We'll talk to you then.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.